I mean, what we've seen in sector after sector is that small businesses are finding they can't survive in brick and mortar traditional stores, or they can only survive doing that if they're also online. So they're moving their businesses increasingly online. But you really can't do a business online on your own. If you just rely on search, people to search your business out and buy from you, you're not going to make it. So then you have to move yourself to the so-called Amazon marketplace. You've got to sell your products over Amazon. But once you do that, you get caught up into the rules of the game that Amazon establishes. And there is lots of evidence, including in a really detailed report from the House Subcommittee on Antitrust last year, that shows Amazon takes a lot of money from those small businesses, but they don't have any choice except to pay it. And then if those small businesses get too successful, Amazon, because of all their data tracking, knows about it and begins a competing business on its own. So the small businesses feel like heads Amazon wins, tail they lose. They can't make it, but they have no choice but to try their best to work through and on Amazon.
Rob Weissman, I want to thank you for being with us, president of Public Citizen. And that does it for our show, Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guster, Libby Rainey, Nermeet Sheikh, Maria Taracena. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. Wear a mask, where to? Stay safe. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 8 a.m. It's time for Wednesday Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is your Wednesday talk radio host, Paul Rowland, coming at you from my, I won't even call it a studio. Basically, I'm on my home phone here at my house, and glad to be doing it. We're going to be talking about why we need a White History Month. Now, don't jump to conclusions. I got that idea from an African-American activist and writer in Chicago, which I'll tell you all about in a minute. But I want to talk a little bit about Black History Month first, because I don't know how many people... I actually have gotten a lot out of listening to radio programs on, you know, in February over the years, first back in D.C., WPFW, one of the flagship Pacifica stations, always been a bulwark in the Black community there in D.C. and has a lot of Afrocentric programming throughout the year, but obviously in Black History Month in February they focus a lot on sort of take a deep dive. So I've gotten a lot out of that. And it's you know, important, because no matter how much I've thought I've been really you know, an aware person, an educated person, I actually only found out in my 50s. It was actually due to Occupy in Washington D.C. in particular, and a particular subgroup, the Criminal Injustice Committee, that arose out of that focused on the criminal injustice system, and was black-led and had a large contingent, including some young Howard University students and some old-time African-American activists in D.C. who are very at all kind of concerned about the term occupy, since they'd rightly felt that they had been living in an occupied city their entire lives. And of course, the siege, the assault, the insurrection on the Capitol puts everything in a whole different light, doesn't it? But anyway, I realized through that, as you know, we learned Michelle Alexander's book had just come out and was having a lot of influence. And anyway, they were a lot more educated than I was, and so I got a lot to, you know, learned about the 13th Amendment. I learned things that I should have learned in school, frankly. And so I was really shocked that I had gone over five decades of life without knowing some of the most crucial facts of our history, which was the history of slavery and the legacy of post-slavery, Reconstruction, and the backlash against Reconstruction and the institution of Jim Crow and all that. I mean, I may have thought I known some of the basic facts, but I really didn't. So I learned that basically from an activist movement, which goes to show the importance of speaking up and the importance of struggle in bringing submerged and suppressed histories to the light of day. So I just want to tell you a few facts, speaking of struggle. It actually turns out that, you probably know, but Black History Month basically grew out of an early effort in the early part of the 20th century, which was Negro History Week, which was launched by Woodson and some others. Actually, it even goes back further than that, but it was chosen because of the birthday of Abraham Lincoln on February 12th and of Frederick Douglass on February 14th. So that was the Negro History Week was centered around that. And of course, February became Black History Month. But at the time of Negro History Week's launch, Woodson contended that the teaching of Black history was essential to ensure the physical and intellectual survival of the race within broader society. So, you know, it was centered around basically educating African Americans about their own history. And of course, that's been really the major focus of it, because Black History Month has really been taken up mostly in Black majority school systems and schools, although now it's, you know, gone broader in an effort to teach the rest of us about that history. I'm just going to read a quote. If a race has no history, it has no worthwhile tradition. It becomes a negligible factor in the thought of the world, and it stands in danger of being exterminated. The American Indian left no continuous record. Well, that's not true, but that's another story. He did not appreciate the value of tradition. Wow. I didn't actually read this beforehand. Okay, we'll just bracket this. And where is he today? The Hebrew keenly appreciated the value of tradition, as is attested by the Bible itself. In spite of worldwide persecution, therefore, he's a great factor in our civilization. Anyway, by 1929, the Journal of Negro History was able to note that with only two exceptions, officials with the State Departments of Education of every state with considerable Negro population had made the event known to that state's teachers and distributed official literature associated with the event. Churches also played a significant role in the distribution of literature in association with Negro History Week during this initial interval, with the mainstream and Black press aiding in the publicity effort. And then it continues throughout the 1930s. Negro History Week countered the growing myth of the South's lost cause, as epitomized in both the novel and the movie Gone with the Wind. That myth argued that slaves had been well treated, that the Civil War was a war of Northern aggression, and that Blacks had been better off under slavery. And don't we still hear those arguments today by some of these purveyors of the lost cause myth? So, but the point I'm trying to make here, one of the points, is that that didn't spread throughout the culture in general. I didn't learn any of the stuff, as I said, in school. Actually, Black History Month was established in 1970 It was first proposed by black educators and the Black United Students at Kent State University in February 1969. Interesting, a year before the massacre at Kent State. And the first celebration of Black History Month took place at Kent State 1 year later. It was only 6 years later that Black History Month was being celebrated all across the country. But, and that was, of course, 1976, the year that I graduated from high school. So no wonder I didn't get any of that in my growing up schooling. And, of course, it really centered then in cities like Washington, D.C., which were majority black. Of course, now it's still most black in terms of ethnicity, but it's no longer 70-80% like it was when I was growing up, right next to it, and I didn't learn any of this. So, with that, I just wanted to sort of give you a little note, but I'm not, you know, in talking about what I'm going to talk about, the need for a white history, which is us teaching ourselves about our real history, as I think Howard Zinn did in his book, The People's History of the United States, which has been extremely influential to a lot of people associated with this radio station and with movements, post-60s movements in general. I'm taught Howard Zinn in any school that I went to, and I frankly don't even recall how U.S. history was taught. Obviously, it wasn't taught in a very engaging or exciting way that would have made me remember it. So, without further ado, I am going to read this article by Diallo Kenyatta, who has his own website called Bro Diallo, D-I-A-L-L-O show. And I guess it goes over a radio station out of Chicago. And he's got a podcast, and he's also a blogger. So I'm just going to read this, so bear with me. It's not that long. Why I Teach White History Month in February. I have abandoned Black History Month and have been celebrating White History Month every February since 2013. I agree with white people who post nonstop complaints about there not being a White History Month. I think you may be being facetious about people talking about being the white people who don't have their own month. In fact, are being put upon by people demanding so much. Anyway, they have had to endure Black History Month every February, not to mention Hispanic Heritage Month, Women's History Month, and even LGBT History Month. I agree that Black History Month is impossible to bear without a White History Month. The whole purpose of setting aside special emphasis months is to focus on the history of historically discriminated groups. It serves to correct past wrongs and inspire oppressed and discriminated people to reach their full potential. This is to be achieved by focusing on historical events and heroes that members of oppressed groups can look up to and model. We get this packaged neatly in one short month, but whites are left out. But who is in more desperate need of positive role models than white people in the U.S.? Black folks have the saintly Martin Luther King Jr., who was the embodiment of love and forgiveness. The noble Malcolm X, whose story of redemption is iconic as well as epic. We also have lesser-known icons, those who persevered and made great contributions to America and the general pride of black folks. Who do black white people have for their general pride? Who has served up to white youth and the general white culture which truly embodies whiteness? George Washington? Mr. Never Tell a Lie? That's a lie. Old Honest Abe, friend of blacks and foe to slavery? White people should be outraged by the way that American society has misrepresented their culture. White history is constructed on easily disprovable myths, which drive the white masses into psychosis. Trying to reconcile those historical myths, lies, and distortions with the reality of the world. I have taken it upon myself to help them. It's sad, really, seeing all these white racists yelling about America being the home of freedom, democracy, and opportunity. What depths of cognitive dissonance must they suffer from to assert that their founding fathers were freedom-loving enslavers? Then there's the historical myth about capitalism and opportunity. Most whites come from dirt, utter lack, like most poor and working class people in this nation. The average white American was little better than the average citizen of the Third World in the time period leading up to World War II. I can attest that's true with my family, my mother's family. Their families only came into the hyper-consuming middle class as a result of the socialist policies of the New Deal. Yet white America hates socialism and credits free market capitalism with bringing them out of the coal mines, sweatshops, and dirt farming and into the suburban affluence and cubicle professions of modern America. This is why they need white history. It is imperative for their mental health. They must understand from which they came, those white men and women who carved this nation into what it is today. And I'm reading Why I Teach White History Month in February by Diallo Kenyatta, an African-American activist and writer in Chicago. Without White History Month, white people are left fragmented and disjointed from their heritage, and perhaps confused and unsure of their place in the world. The myths that most whites are fed about their history don't just distort their personal self-image, it has real-world impacts. It is devastating to whites and the rest of the world. The illusion that whites reach their hyper-consuming middle-class status through morality, hard work, and their own intelligence instead of government handouts and set-asides are just one of the misconceptions that drives more than half of voting-age whites to vote against their own economic and class interest. In their efforts to deny black single mothers access to food stamps, they have committed economic hari-kari. Poor and working-class whites celebrate tax cuts, even when they work for the state or they contract with the state, simply because they honestly think black people are getting over. It's insane. Whites support imperialist and genocidal wars because of their ignorance of their history. They embrace policies that will render the planet unlivable because of their ignorance of history. They attack vulnerable populations who pose no threat to them while embracing and supporting the true threat to their well-being, the corporate elites. I have abandoned Black History Month and have been celebrating White History Month every February since 2013. I seek out the truth of white history and its impacts on the white majority and the rest of us. It is truly fascinating. If revealing black history to black people is supposed to motivate us to be better people, to overcome persistent challenges we face in the society, then why not for whites as well? And I must continually emphasize that these are not my words. These are the words of an African-American activist and writer from Chicago. If whites learn about their radical history, their proud class struggles against the parasitic elites, their defiance of established religions and political powers, maybe they will stop fearing immigrants, thugs, and welfare queens, and once again target corrupt politicians, multinational corporations, and the military-industrial complex. Maybe the fight for social justice and human rights will not be a fringe issue among the white majority. Maybe the soccer moms and the white dudes who paint their bellies at football games will take up the struggle and unite with humanity against the capitalist overlords, as opposed to being fodder for the corporate war machine. Maybe instead of a Columbus Day parade, we might have Smedley Butler Day parades. Maybe we can remove Andrew Jackson from U.S. currency and replace him with, I don't know, William Lloyd Garrison, perhaps? Who knows? But none of this has a chance of going down as long as whites remain so damn ignorant of their history. As long as white history is presented as one long commercial for industrial and finance capitalism. One white historian accused me of being anti-white, asserting that I promote the idea that whites have done only evil things in history. I told her that I wasn't promoting this idea. White people like her and white institutions promote this idea. They chose to highlight white villains as historical heroes. They chose to have parades, major statues, and epic movies made for the worst of white society. I didn't make that call. Where is the John Brown National Holiday? Where is the Karl Marx Institute of Economics? Where is the Eugene Debs Memorial Statue? Hell, I'd even settle for an Eleanor Roosevelt signature line of fragrances in the cosmetics department of Macy's. Principled people in white history are villainized or ignored because while their society's savages are polished off and elevated in their culture. I didn't make that decision. I was lied to about George Washington and the Founding Fathers, too, about World War I and World War II and all other aspects of white history since I entered kindergarten. But I, thankfully, get to celebrate those that embody true blackness every winter. I am not left confused by the smooth lines painted over the sharp and jagged landscape carved by white history. They deserve a month, too. They deserve to reflect at the beginning of the year. They need reminders, TV specials, Budweiser posters, and a special aisle in Target to reinvigorate their whiteness and align their nature, desires, and past. they need the true heroes of white history in all their glory in order to, for good or bad, to recalibrate. I encourage black people to stop trying to articulate why it's appropriate to have a Black History Month in the U.S. and just give many whites what they want. Begin to research and share the facts of white history, post them on social media and in your community. I promise you, those same people who complain about the absence of White History Month will either go away or wake the hell up. Win, win. I enjoyed reading that. I hope you enjoyed listening to that. Why I Teach White History Month in February by Diallo Kenyatta, who again has his own website, DialloKenyatta.com, D-I-A-L-L-O, Kenyatta, KENYATTA.com, list of some of his most recent podcasts: Socialism for the Rich, Reparations and Political Reductionism, Reparation, Black Spirituality, etc. Anyway, I thought that was well worth reading. I invite your calls at 503-231-8187. I also wanted to take it perhaps even a little deeper. I think that not only are there these culture wars, which in a way you could call history wars, because we really do have, I mean, there are people who just frankly celebrate, you know, the invasion of the Americas by Europeans and the enslavement of Black Americans and the entire history, and they feel that, you know, European Americans are somehow still at the pinnacle of world culture, despite all evidence the contrary. Most emphatically, what that culture has now done to the planet. So yeah, there are people, but there, you know, I'd say a lot more people who are just frankly totally confused and just have a mishmash of beliefs. I mean, if you just listen to people who, you know, go to those free speech, the Patriot Prayer demos that were going on here in Portland, and the people who invaded the Capitol. I mean, for crying out loud, I heard some people, one person yelling amongst all the other idiocies that people were yelling there, "We built this," referring to the Capitol, when of course everybody should know it was actually built from slave labor, as were a lot of the other monumental buildings there in Washington, D.C. Anyway, I could talk about growing up in D.C. and coming to a certain amount of awareness and seeing all those shiny white buildings as basically this symbols of empire and colonization. But the reason why we need to know our own history goes back even further. I mean, to understand the colonization and the enslavement of African people and the building of this vast empire of the United States, you have to go back hundreds and thousands of years and understand the real origins of empire civilization itself. And I feel that's it's a big ask, and a lot of people, when I try to talk about this with people, they kind of, maybe their eyes glaze over, maybe your eyes are glazing over right now, who knows, and they just don't see the relevance to the urgent issues of the day. But I would assert that just like in order to understand how we got mass incarceration, you have to understand Jim Crow, you have to understand the reaction to radical reconstruction, you have to understand the real history of the United States going all the way back. In order to understand all that, you have to understand even further back. You have to understand how empire itself developed, how expansionist civilization itself developed. There's no way we can understand the world we're living in today without understanding that. Anyway, that's my appeal. That's what I would like to talk about today. I encourage you to call me up, 503-231-8187. You have just over half an hour left. Don't wait till the last 5-10 minutes of the show. I know there's some of you out there just chomping at the bit to, I don't know, maybe you want to argue with me. Maybe you want to dispute some of the things I've been saying. I'd love to hear that. Love to hear you build a positive conversation around this theme. Well, if no one's going to call right away, I did have a, speaking of white history, I thought this was a really crucial piece of information about what happened at in the Washington, D.C., at the Capitol a few weeks ago. This is an article, Trump Defense Secretary disarmed D.C. National Guard before Capitol riot. It's originally appeared on Daily KOs. I'm reading it from the National Memo article by Mark Sumner. In testimony before the House this week, Capitol Police and D.C. National Guard officials acknowledged that by January 4th, they understood that, quote, the January 6th event would not be like any of the previous protests held in 2020. We knew that militia groups and white supremacist organizations would be attending. We also knew that some of these participants were intending to bring firearms and other weapons to the event. We knew that there was a strong potential for violence and that Congress was the target. On that same day, former Acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller, that same day meaning January 4th, issued a memo to the Secretary of the Army placing some extremely unusual limits on National Guard forces for that event. It's not a to-do list. It's a list of thou shalt nots, a long list, a list that says Guard forces can't arrest any of the pro-Trump protesters or search them or even touch them. And that's just for starters. The full memo shows that the D.C. Guard did receive a request from D.C. government for Guard presence during the January 6th event. Responds promptly to go ahead so long as the soldiers are given no weapons, no body armor, and no helmets. They can bring agents like pepper spray or flashbangs. They can't share any gear with Capitol Police or Metro DC Police. They can't really do much of anything. When initial reports indicate that the handful of National Guard forces that were deployed to DC on that day were dedicated to directing traffic several blocks away from the area of the Trump rally, it may simply be because that's the only thing they could find for them to do considering the restrictions that were given. It's clear that these restrictions would have absolutely prevented any Guard forces from trying to protect any location. In addition to this memo, another grim document of the January 6th insurgency emerged on Thursday. As the New York Times reports, body cam footage, deliberately not inserted here, from officers on the Capitol steps used in court when bringing charges against Michael Foy, a Michigan man who attacked the police with a hockey stick. In addition to Foy's attack, the minute of video captures a grisly.
teeth as it is. So take heart and take care of your link with life. It's beautiful.
Okay, well, if anybody's still listening, we're back. I don't know what happened, but the phone lines went down there for a bit. That was weird. I assume that wasn't any intervention by evil forces. So, yeah, I was reading this incredible article, Trump Defense Secretary Disarmed D.C. National Guard Before Capitol Riot. And before I continue reading, if this isn't made part of the impeachment proceedings, Christopher Miller should be called to testify, because this is, they have to lay out the entire scenario. If they narrow it to just, what Trump himself said and did, if they don't use the subpoena power to actually compel people like Christopher Miller and, other functionaries in the intelligence establishment to talk about, who gave orders, what was really going on, then it'll be just another miserable failure of an impeachment proceeding. Okay, so in addition to the Christopher Miller memo, another grim document of the January 6th insurgency emerged on Thursday. As New York Times reports, body cam footage, deliberately not inserted here, from officers on the Capitol steps was used in court when bringing charges against Michael Foy, a Michigan man who attacked the police with a hockey stick. In addition to Foy's attack, the minute of video captures a grisly scene, the moment when 34-year-old Roseanne Boylan is trampled to death on the Capitol steps by fellow insurgents rushing forward to join the attack on police. At least one person in the crowd notices what is happening and shouts, "Save her!" But the wave of insurgents battering at police with flagpoles and lengths of pipe never pauses. Only seconds later, Boylan's friend Justin Winchell shouts, "She's going to die! She's dead!" He attempts to get help from those around him, but what he gets is a face full of chemical agent that rioters behind him are aiming at the police. Boylan's death is far from the only moment of shocking violence in the video. As insurgents scream that they will kill the police, and officers are toppled and dragged down the stairs. By the end of the brief video, the police are down as the Trump supporters kick them and beat them over and over. The wonder isn't that someone died, it's that it wasn't more. Considering the limits that Miller set on National Guard forces, including no helmet and no body armor, it's a good thing that none of them were present at the Capitol. They would not have survived. So that's a very grim recounting. But it looks like we actually do hopefully have a caller. We had Joan. I guess Joan's probably not still with us. Maybe Brian. Let's see who we got. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is Brian. Can you hear me?
Huh? Yep.
Yeah, I tried quite a few times earlier, but wasn't getting through. And then you disappeared. That was a bummer. But now you're back. Thanks.
The phone lines were all down momentarily for some reason anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm just calling to kind of put something out there. Maybe other people will call back with their experience. You know, I read people's recounts of their younger years, and they're so detailed, and they have such memories. And, of course, I have memories, but it's just not as detailed as I wish it were. But I have a overall sort of vibe from my earlier years in history that I learned in elementary school. And I wonder if there are other people out there that might. My theory that I'm developing is that maybe I was educated in a little window. I was in first grade in, I think it was 67 or 68, and then you can, you know, I stayed with my schedule, prescribed schedule, from there on out. A lot of my elementary education was in South Carolina. So I can't remember specific things, but somehow as a young adolescent or whatever, I felt like I'd always had this sense of believing in racial equality. And, you know, and obviously I'm finding out recently how lacking I really was, but I've always had this basic feeling of a desire for racial equality and feeling, you know, that that's what we should do. And I don't know if that might have been a product of my education right after civil rights and right after busing, all that stuff was happening. I wonder if I might have just caught a little wave of some education that helped me along that path. And then also, well, I moved to upstate New York when I was in older elementary, and we learned about the Iroquois Indians, the Seneca Indians. We learned how they used fish, and they grew the Three Sisters, and all this neat stuff that I do have memories of that. So I did get some broader education somehow, and I wonder if there are other people that might have had that same as a young white person in America, if they actually had some spots of, or how do you say, maybe it was a regional thing, maybe it was very spotty, maybe it happened here and there, maybe it had something to do with timing, you know, like civil rights and such. Anyway, that's what I had to say.
Okay, well, the main thrust of the article, of course, was really to sort of bring back our own hidden history, just as African American History Month is originally to educate African Americans about, you know, their own real history, and to sort of pull them out of the sort of the psychology of despair and the, you know, the ignorance, because they weren't allowed to be educated, almost all of them. No, they couldn't write and couldn't. So yeah, it was, and then, you know, obviously Latin History Month is obviously to bring out, you know, the history of the, you know, Mexican-American War, the theft of, you know, large parts that are now considered part of the United States. So the idea is to our own sort of hidden history of, you know, class struggle and our own true heroes. I think that was the main thrust of the article. Of course,
I get that. But I think behind all of that is also, he's being a little tongue-in-cheek by this whole thing, is what I'm gathering, and totally warranted, and I get it, and I really dig. I love the article. It was awesome. But I also think that if you go back, I'm, you know, my ages, you can figure it out from the math that I did. Excuse me. But I think before that, before we had Black History Month and Latin American, you know, all that, there was a real dearth. You know, I grew up in, and I think I'm not alone with mostly, you know, George Washington, you know, cutting down the cherry tree and then admitting that he lied, that kind of stuff. I grew up with a lot of that, but then I also got some other stuff. But I totally agree with the article. I think that's a great idea to teach people the true, you know, history of white America would be awesome.
Right. So, yeah, anyway. I mean, in terms of your personal, it's hard. I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear other people's, you know, obviously we get influences beyond just school. So, you know, who knows, you might have been, you know, saw on TV, you know, and also, the struggles of the lunch counter, you know, you might have identified with them. You know, I think we're all different. Why are some people actually sensitive to that sort of thing? Was it your parents? Were you just personally different? I mean, these are all kind of difficult things to calculate. But yeah, I think probably the regional aspect of learning the Iroquois history, being in New York, I assume that was probably a big part of it. I certainly didn't learn. You know, my memory of elementary school, of course, I was living actually abroad. I was actually in the Philippines until the fifth grade. So I probably got a really virulent, your American-centric, Eurocentric version of history. But I remember in sixth grade, I got the sort of the We learned about Greece. You know, we had this sort of, you know, I think it was so Eurocentric. It was weeks and weeks of studying, you know, the Crete and Sparta and the Greeks. And I think that was a huge part. I think Eurocentric, a bad form of Eurocentrism, you know, sort of the kings and the emperors and the queens and the, you know, that was a huge part of education until, you know, until Howard Zinn and People's History and the whole 60s sort of mini revolution really changed things dramatically. But anyway, well, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. The number is 503-231-8187. That was Brian. Joan called earlier, and when the phone stopped working, she got cut off. So if you want to call back, please do. Otherwise, we had a little bit of a problem there. 5-minute dead air gap. Not good. Not good. I guess, of course, my board op tie played some music, but I hope people stuck through that and are still listening. And remember that the show started out with me reading a article called "Why Teach White History Month in February" by Diallo Kenyatta. Just to give you a hint, if you just tuned in, he said the whole purpose of setting aside special emphasis months is to focus on the history of historically discriminated groups. It serves to correct past wrongs and inspire oppressed and discriminated people to reach their full potential. This is to be achieved by focusing on historical events and heroes that members of oppressed groups can look up to and model. We get this packaged neatly in one short month, but whites are left out. But who is in more desperate need of positive role models than white people in the U.S.? And that's his, is it George Washington? Is it Honest Abe? No, he talks about, the real leaders in the struggle against the corporate elites and the lies that history has told us about capitalism and opportunity and such like. So I highly recommend this. It's linked on my program page, kboo.fm, Wednesday Talk Radio. But if you'd like to join the conversation, call 503-231-8187. I also, speaking of white history, talked about some of the history behind the events at the Capitol, which is obviously, it's really the culmination of years and years and years of this this culture war, this history war, this inculcation of these insane founding myths of this culture that leads people to believe that they are really the aggrieved parties, privileged white people. You know, so many of those people were actually professionals. There were CEOs. I mean, what was up with that? These people that they're so deep into the mythologized version of the United States. So I don't know. My take on Trumpism that I said early on in the presidency, and my hope, my only hope for it was that it would sort of be like a boil on the skin that would burst and sort of reveal the worst of United States culture. And I think I really did pretty much say it in those terms. And in some ways, it's coming true. And in some ways, the event at the Capitol, you know, if it can go various ways. It can go, you know, it certainly is emboldening people to see what's possible. But it also reveals, you know, it's certainly going to hurt a lot of the people who are the most gung-ho and leaders in that white supremacist America First MAGA movement. So that's going to, you know, be a blow. Of course, you know, maybe they'll all write their Mein Kampf in prison. But anyway, looks like we got another caller. So I'd like to hear what Anna has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Laura. I'm wondering, was that Buffy St. Marie that you had playing while there was a glitch in the phone situation?
Yeah, actually, my theme song is one of Buffy's songs from her Medicine Songs album, and I guess Ty was just playing more music from that. Yeah, Buffy St. Marie.
Thank goodness I haven't heard her on air for such a long time. Thank you for playing her. I actually, a long time ago in the late, 70s, I had lunch with her in Sausalito.
No way.
Yes. It was a very nice, I'm not going to go into that because it's not part of the situation that's going on right now that I wanted to help out with. We, as human beings, live on this earth, which is fully, astronomers know, is affected by the magnetic field. And three times a year for about 3 weeks, there is something called Mercury retrograde, and all kinds of glitches happen with communication devices, computers, telephones, that kind of stuff. So expect it until the 22nd of February. That's
okay.
That's one subject, yeah. And then the white, the subject of your talk here is whites having their own, what, white day?
Well, is this African-American author, Diallo Kenyatta, wrote Why I Teach White History Month in February.
Oh, he's a black man teaching white history.
It's a kind of a complex argument. You should check out the article and you'll get it. It's kind of hard to, it's hard with radio and people tune in at different times. It's worth reading.
Great. Well, that's an expert point. I mean, anybody who's black who's talking about white history knows what they're talking about. Because I'm a white person, but I'm another thing I did way back in the early 70s, like 1970, was I was invited to sit in, if I kept my mouth closed, on a Black Panther meeting. I did that in Pasadena, California. So I'm a special white person.
Yeah, those are two really, you really had a privilege to be able to meet Buffy St. Marie and sit in a meeting. I guess you know there's a new movie about Fred Hampton and the name of the infiltrator who helped lead to his assassination, whose name I can't remember, but there's a new movie that was featured on Democracy Now! a couple days ago. And it also just came out that finally documents reveal that J. Edgar Hoover was actually responsible for the assassination of Fred Hampton, which we already knew, but it's actually come out, which is also another interesting fact.
It's so sad that things that are true come out decades later, but we are due, all of us on planet Earth here, are due for some huge revelations this year. And,
okay. Well, we heard it here first.
What's that?
I said we heard it here first.
Yes, of course. KBOO is the station. When I lived down in California, it was KPFA for me.
Yeah.
But Howard Zinn is someone I need to study. What?
Well, thank you for calling, Anna.
Yeah, okay. So
appreciate it. 503-231-8187. Of course, KPFA was the original listener-sponsored radio, the model for all others that came along, like KBOO. And it looks like we've got another caller, and only about 10 minutes left, so get your call in, 503-231-8187. Greg, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi there. Hey, since we're telling stories today, I've been waiting and chomping at the bit for months during the unrest this summer, right? So we're at Black History Month. You're talking about White History Month. Hoping, you know, there's more people out there that will, you know, understand what I'm saying, but do we all know that race does not exist? There are no subspecies of humans, right?
So okay.
Bothers me to a large degree, and hey, I just found out about this stuff just a few years ago, you know. I've read a lot.
Do you find it an irony that race doesn't exist, but racism does?
Absolutely not. It's just, you have to understand how deep the indoctrination here is in this country. One of the many things I call America is the United States of Amnesia. For instance, we're not supposed to realize that we overthrew Ukraine almost 7 years ago now. In fact, we had an impeachment of the president based on, you know, pretending that Ukraine was an independent country. The amnesia is working here all the time. So I read a very good book that I found out about on KABU a few years ago, called The History of White People. Sounded very interesting. Well, the first time I read it, I didn't get it, partially because the writer of that book didn't have a good conclusion, didn't really tie it together in a way that makes sense. I understand it a little more now. So, remember a few years back, we had this white person who tried to pass for black. She was leading the NCAA chapter in Spokane.
Yep.
We had this big uproar, and I thought, well, this is weird. Amy had a really good show after that, just before the Charleston church shooting, literally like the day before, and had these African-American academics on there, and they kept saying there was no scientific basis for race, but yet they keep using the word. So I went back and read that book a second time, History of White People, and it's, the whole story is in there. White supremacy.
Right. Well, it was a social construction, but social constructions are very powerful, and they actually do become.
And this one went on for hundreds of years. So white supremacy race theory is white supremacy.
Indeed.
This went on for hundreds of years as we try to.
It's still going on today. Well, thank you very much. Looks like we've got another caller. 503-231-8187. Thank you, Greg. We got Joe up next. Go ahead, Joe.
Hey, thanks for squeezing me in. I think the last caller kind of set me up to ask you what I wanted to ask earlier or bring up, which is Noel Ignatieff's book, How the Irish Became White. That is a very kind of specific history of how Irish settlers in the North American continent, you know, went from being formerly colonized subjects to these participants in this project of dominating, of colonizing the North American continent, and how we often think that the Irish are lily white. Who is whiter than the Irish? And at one point, there were other people who were whiter than the Irish. And it's a very interesting book I started to read about the history, not only of that process of becoming complicit in the colonial project, but also the repressed history of the Irish cause for throwing off their oppressors being bound up with material support and relationships with abolition in this country. And that might actually be a great St. Patrick's Day episode for you next month. I know it's going to be a Wednesday.
Oh, well, you've already researched it. Okay, I'd like you to send me more info on that. I think you know how to get in touch with me. That's interesting. But yeah, I mean, I being of Italian American, I mean, my own personal story is a little different from what we think of as, you know, the main body of Italian Americans who came, you know, at the end of the 19th and the early part of the 20th century. But you know, my dad was darker skinned. I'm slightly darker skinned, and I'm sure if I had, you know, if he had come earlier, you know, I actually never talked to him about what I'm sure he suffered some form of whatever you want to call it. Can't exactly call it racism, but yeah, I mean, it's a very parallel thing for the Italian Americans as for the Irish Americans.
Yeah, well, that's a book by an author who I guess died just a couple years ago, and he was known in his life, especially once he became an academic later in life, for promoting what the previous caller was referring to as like the social constructedness of race, but like approaching it in a material way and saying we have to abolish that. And to abolish that doesn't mean we just erase it, say, from our language, but that we look at the way in which it is embodied in real things and change those.
Sounds like you've got a little one there. Hello?
Yep. Yeah, that's Cable Community for you.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. It adds a whole other dimension. But you can find it at the Irish became white. What's that?
Noel Ignatieff. Yeah, you can find it at the Multnomah County Library. And Noel Ignatieff is the author's name, How the Irish Became White.
Okay, well, thanks for Joe. Always good to hear you. 503-231-8187. Got time for one more caller if you want to get in at the end here. So, yeah, I mean, it's a very complex subject, but in some ways quite simple. As my co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, speaking of history, has given us some really valuable perspectives on history and culture, and in particular the indigenous Native American perspective, talks about, and you know, we increasingly know, because of all these marginalized, oppressed voices finally breaking through into the culture, that, you know, Virginia was really, in a lot of ways, the site of the construction of racialism in the United States, and really which spread throughout, you know, the United States was really the kind of the crucible for that. It didn't really exist the same way, from what I understand, in other countries. Obviously, the slave trade brought it up so dramatically, because, you know, Africans who were enslaved, mostly from, you know, the blacker sub-Saharan part of the continent, were very dark-skinned, and so it created a stark contrast with the much whiter people from Europe, England, Germany, the ones who really controlled the origins of the United States. Obviously, that's it was in their interest to use that difference in skin color to construct a whole ordered hierarchy, and use that to draw in, as Joe was talking about, the newer waves of immigrants who got to put themselves above the people on the lowest rungs, the African descendants and the indigenous people who are also darker skinned. So yeah, it's the history of this country, and as I said, it certainly reached a boiling point there at the Capitol. White supremacy on display. They certainly thought I don't know what they were thinking, but they certainly didn't hide the fact that what they're doing, and now thank goodness a lot of them are actually paying for it. And what's going to happen with impeachment will be interesting to see, if they do actually broaden the lens and really bring in a lot of the functionaries of the white supremacist state Trump version, and really look at it in a deeper and broader view. Of course, they're going to be, limited into what they can bring in, because they've got only a week to do it, I guess. But anyway, that's what I have to say. I encourage you to go to my page on KBOO.fm, Wednesday Talk Radio. Read this article, Why I Teach White History Month in February, by Diallo Kenyatta, an African-American activist and writer out of Chicago, who again has his own website, DialloKenyatta.com. Looks like I'm just out of time, so thank everybody for listening. Thank all of you who called in, and talk to you next week. Bye, everybody.
Hold your your head up. Lift the top of your mind. Put your eyes on the earth. Lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? Are you here to improve or damn it?
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Talk and Taste, Getting Vaccinated for the Love of Health, hosted by Preserve Coalition. On Wednesday, February 10th, from 1:00